Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Brilliant Friends Show. I am your Nicholas Lorimer, and today I am joined by Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you?
Delighted. Delighted at a spring Monday and confused.
Yes.
Dazed and confused? No, delighted and confused.
Yeah, we will get into the reasons for that, I suspect, in a moment. And of course, we are also joined by the great and wise Ms. Saragar. Sarah, how are you?
Oh, well, thank you, Nick. Thank you.
Very good. So let us start off with a topic that we're not going to dwell too much on because it is certainly going to come up again in the next few days on the Daily Friend and probably on the Daily Friend show as well. And that is anyone who follows the media, particularly places like the Daily Maverick recently, will have seen that there have been a number of attacks on the Institute of Race Relations, which is, of course, the great evil mastermind behind the Daily Friend. And the most recent of these was a letter signed by 80 people, most of whom were involved with the Institute of Race Relations, mostly in the 80s, saying that the IRR has moved away from the legacy of its founders and lost its way and strayed from its founding principles. Specifically that its two founding principles to work for the peace, goodwill, and practical cooperation between the various sections of the populations of South Africa and to initiate, support, assist, and encourage investigations that may lead to greater knowledge and understanding of the racial groups and the relations that subsist or should subsist between them, that the IRR has strayed from these things. So we will definitely return to this topic, but just very briefly on this, Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is the story is as old as the hills. What does non-racialism mean? To some people, non-racialism means the soft bigotry of low expectations, treating white people and black people morally differently, judging people by the color of their skin and not the content of their character. That's what they think non-racialism means. So in their opinion, of course, the IRR is no longer non-racial. And there's more to say. But for those who think the English language does a good enough job to explain itself, non-racialism means non-racialism. That's what we stand for. It's hugely unpopular amongst the elites. And yeah, someone said, and I'll quote them, that the 80 people, I don't think they were mostly from the IRR, some were, but that they did seem like a good long list of all the so-called liberal slideaways in the last couple of decades. And yeah, tough techies for them. They're losing. Right. We're winning. It's great.
Just one comment. I mean, of all the things they accused us of when they stated that, you know, the problem is we want to advance a free market economy. And I thought, and that's bad. How? I rest my case.
Right. Anyway.
Nicholas slowly sips from his Ronald Reagan cup.
Free market
yes, maybe.
Economy.
let us move on then to perhaps more substantive things, and the first of which is a story which we have covered a lot in the recent days and which Gabriel has been very closely paying attention to the details of, and that is the battle to prevent the postponement of the election and then to prevent the opening of the IEC candidate lists once the election postponement was declared null and void. Gabriel, the Constitutional Court handed down its judgment this morning. And can you tell us what the results were?
Yeah, so the first question that the IRR asked the court to answer is, if the IEC can just scratch a deadline that's already passed, where did it get that power? Now, everyone in the media and the IEC have said it gets that power because it's, quote, reasonably necessary to reopen this thing for a long, silly story about age of majority and people who turned 18 the day before something didn't happen. We said this is nonsense. It's not reasonably necessary to achieve the goal that the court set out, which is to reopen voter registration. Now, there, I'm very happy to say the court completely agreed with us and with basically no one else. It said that Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma's proclamation on the 3rd of August was irrational. It is just about the strongest rebuke that you can make. And we were the first to accuse her of being irrational. So because that was irrational, the court had to reopen voter registration, but it was not reasonably necessary to therefore reopen candidate nominations. So in this regard, we were right. And even very good faith people like Graham McIntosh, who's very close with the IRR, holds the record for being the longest serving member of parliament that's alive. He disagreed with us, challenged the IRR on Politics Web. He was wrong. We were right. And we're glad for that. In good faith, sometimes it's nice to know that you're right. Also, because the original proclamation was rendered a nullity, the IEC's argument that it could change everything because there was a postponement, and one section seems to say that if there's a postponement, you can start fresh, that was also deemed to be irrational or unreasonable or nonsense or incorrect. And I see that one of our first commentators, Jacques van der Spey, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, has made that exact point on the comment section. He's right. We were right. We said this to the court. The court agreed. So the third question is, well, does the IEC get this power from ordinary legislation? In other words, if you forget all the special things about the pandemic and the Concord order, which invalidates Dlamini Zuma's proclamation, if this was just a bone average election, could the IEC watch a deadline go by for anything and then decide afterwards, nah, that didn't work out for us. We're going to change the deadline and put it somewhere new. Now, the IRR submitted that the IEC can never do that, that that would not be in the interest of justice. But we didn't argue this on the basis of structure. I mean, I think if you just think structurally what makes sense, how could that possibly be reasonable? We didn't make that argument. People often do make these kinds of arguments. We respect them. We didn't make that. We said it's in the law. And that's because the law says, and this is a little bit difficult to quote exactly, but I will try. The law says in section 11.3, any act to be performed in terms of this law must be performed by no later than a date and time stated in the election timetable. So the Municipal Electoral Act says, firstly, the IEC must publish a timetable. That's 11.1. Then it says it can change the timetable at its own discretion. That's 11.2. But 11.3 then says it can't do anything about an item on the timetable once the date of that item on the timetable has passed. In other words, we submitted that once the date is passed, a guillotine falls that cuts off the IEC's hand from reaching backwards into time. Going forward, on August 21st, on August 22nd, on August 23rd, the IEC can delay the candidate nominations as much as it likes, as long as it doesn't stop the November 1 deadline. But it can delay and it doesn't have to explain itself to anyone. But once August 23 has passed, we submitted it can't do that. And I think that we were just reading plain English. But I'm not a lawyer. Our lawyers thought we were right, but the Concord justices thought we were wrong. And it's important for us to be respectful here, and we are respectful, because this judgment was not a majority judgment. This judgment was not even a unanimous judgment given in a justice's name. This judgment was given in the name of the court, which is the most firm, unanimous, stringent way that the court can hand down an interpretation of the law. And what this means is for people like me who thought we were in a world where the IEC can change things in advance, but it can't change things in retrospect because the law stops that, we turn out to be wrong. And on the Concord's interpretation, in a regular election, I can't see any reason why the IEC can't, after an actual election, decide that that election wasn't good enough and then retrospectively change the deadline for the election until another deadline, as long as it's before the constitutional deadline. So that is a major concern. The IEC, as it seems, on the court's interpretation, could literally cancel an election that's already happened at its own discretion. That's very worrying. And so probably the law needs to be amended so that what 11.3 seemed to do actually gets done. Now, this is long and this is technical, but it matters, because this sets the precedent for every election we face until if the law changes. As things stand, the IEC can change things forward and it can reach its hand into the past and change anything at its own discretion. Does that mean the court says the IEC is credible, honorable, that it's been making sense? No. The court said, clearly the IEC told us something was impossible. Now it says it's possible. It said it became Herculean, I quote, as a way to explain a mythological explanation of how it changed its powers. The court sympathetically tries to understand it. And it is the court's duty to, if its interpretation of the law is correct, to grant as much leeway to the IEC as possible. ahead of the time. Again, we've got this difference in time. What can you do ahead of the time? What can you do after the time? After the time, the court has explicitly said the door is open. If we are not saying that this was reasonably necessary, in fact, we're saying this certainly wasn't reasonably necessary in terms of our order. We're saying this certainly wasn't empowered by the postponement. We're saying we can't really second guess what the IEC says. And most importantly, a technicality, because this was heard on the papers, there was no oral argument. The court's ability to doubt a party that says the IEC was accused of bias by various parties. And the IEC said, no, of course we're not biased. The court must basically agree with the IEC, defer, give it the benefit of even a slim, slim, tiny doubt, because there was no cross-examination, because it was the first port of entry, so there's no option for review. There's all these technical reasons that the court had to respect the IEC's discretion. And that does also mean the court has kept the door wide open. If you want to challenge this thing afterwards, go ahead. And if there are IEC whistleblowers that are prepared, if it happened, to admit what kind of phone call led to this most extraordinary decision to burn a past deadline, then we'll be very interested to find out what goes on there. In our press statement, we said the IEC cannot complain if it faces utmost scrutiny, because where the law has left a gap, citizens must fill that gap to protect ourselves from election abuse.
Sarah, your thoughts on all of this, and also what the potential political ramifications of this will be going forward, considering the ANC is going to be able to put all of its candidates forward.
I can't really add to anything Gabriel says, but just to look at the actual issue. It's not the first time the IEC has been faced with parties whose candidates have not been put on, not on the candidates list in time. That's been the way things roll since democracy. However, on this occasion, a huge number of candidates from the ruling party did not get onto the list. And at the end of the day, after a whole lot of dishonest comments about how they were stymied by the IEC technical processes and computers, etc., the ANC actually admitted publicly that the failure to get the people onto the list was its fault. I mean, I don't want to be unduly sort of conspiratorial here, but I think there was it was a political decision, which, you know, I think we've come to expect better from the Constitutional Court. And I agree with Gabriel that the fact that everything was on the papers and so it could not be drilled down orally, which can make a difference. We've seen it make a difference before. I think that's hugely problematic. It just doesn't make any logical sense.
Yeah, well said.
If I can add one thing.
Sure.
Which is that, so, I mean, I want to show the best respect to the court that I can, especially given the nature of its judgment. But since I think that its judgment is wrong, I can't pretend I think it's right. And then the question goes, well, how could it possibly sort of misread what seems to be such a plain English thing? Like, Section 11.3 seems to say you can't change anything after the fact on the timetable. How come the court says this section does not constrain the IEC's ability to amend prospectively or retrospectively? How can it come to that decision? I don't know. But in terms of inferring some kind of motive, it's also worth considering the fact that if the ANC had been barred, we now have seen the numbers in the court's judgment. There were 500 wards, I think, or 600 wards that it had no candidates in, and 13 municipalities that it had a strong majority in 2016, where it would de facto definitely lose. 11 where it's had a strong majority for a long, long time. So if you think there are nearly 300 municipalities, 11 or 13 is not that many, but it's also a lot of places to burn to the ground. And if we are going to assume that the Concord read against the grain for some reason, my opening suggestion is that they read against the grain in the hopes of protecting South Africa from the eventuality of people burning down voting stations where the ANC is not on the ballot. And that's not what the law allows, and I'm not convinced that that's what they've done. But it is kind of scary, and And I suppose in some sense, because this is a fait accompli, because we have lost in this regard, we might as well be relieved that the ANC won't have an excuse to burn things down and that it won't have an excuse to say that it lost on a technicality. The ANC is not looking very good. And because of its ideology and its commitment to that ideology in the last few years, seeming so unwavering, I think that it's important that South Africans get a chance to push back.
Well said. All right. So I will just say very briefly that we did actually test this before the show, but I always forget how enthusiastic Gabriel is when talking. And unfortunately, his mic is bumping a little bit against his beard, which is that slight rustling you can hear in the background.
I'm sorry.
So no problem. So Gabriel.
It's the cricket in the thorn tree.
Yes, the rustling.
See if you can switch your mic. I'll just mute you quick while we move on to the next topic. All right, let us jump ahead. Sorry, I've lost my notes here. Here they are. So, of course, we had over the weekend the South African, the registration weekend, which, of course, was supposed to be back in July, but, of course, Susana Dlamini Zuma, in her wisdom, decided to basically crush that one. And it went ahead yesterday. And, well, South Africans, by and large, don't seem to have come out in huge numbers to register. There was some registration. Darby Schultz, who is a guy who does elections analysis on Twitter, he's very good at looking at numbers, says that I think it was only 325,000 registrations on the weekend, which is a pretty low number. Now, that's not all of them, because actually until 12 o'clock tonight, you are able to change your registration or register to vote online on the IEC's website. So if you did miss the weekend and you do want to vote, please do and go and check out the IEC's website and register there, and you can get to vote there. Anyway, the upshot of all this is that the voters' roll has shrunk by 750,000 voters since 2019, which is quite spectacular. And there's a lot of early signs that this is going to be a low turnout election. But turnout is not the same for all political parties. So what's interesting is I talked actually to a DA councillor in Soweto who lives and works there over the weekend, and he said that in Soweto, at least, there have been protests since last week, Wednesday, about electricity problems, and that this meant that there were an enormous number of voting stations in Soweto closed, actually, on the weekend by protesters, and that by and large, the mood in Soweto is extremely unhappy, and I suspect that that reflects a lot of the ANC strongholds across the country. Cyril Ramaphosa and the Joburg mayor, who unfortunately passed away after a terrible car accident. His name is Jolidi Matongo. He died in a terrible car accident on the way back from an event with Cyril Ramaphosa on Sunday. At the same event, though, Cyril was booed by residents of Soweto who were extremely upset about the electricity issue. One of them, quoted in the Sowetan, said, "Where was the ANC in the past 3 years when you didn't have electricity? All of these police that are here, where were they when members of the community were getting killed? Where were they? They must F off, man." So not a good weekend for the ANC. They've lost yet another major political leader in a key metro to Jeff Mukubo died to COVID, and Jolidi Matongo has now died in a car crash. So the party's going to have to elect a new mayor, which probably means more infighting just before the election. It really doesn't look like a good weekend for them. Whereas the DA in their strongholds appears to have registered a large number of people, relatively speaking, at least compared to the ANC. So, Sara, what is your take on all of this that's going on? I've covered a lot there, so feel free to pick and choose what's most interesting to you.
Yeah. Look, I think we're seeing this sort of almost a fever pitch of anger and frustration at the ANC from ordinary supporters. I mean, it's been coming over the past few years, and it was reflected in some of the changes that resulted from the elections in 2016. But I think, I think they've said that people believe that there's been more corruption under Ramaphosa than there was under Zuma. I'm not sure if that's actually true, whether it's just coming to light, but I think what's part of what's really sort of helping to push potential voters is it's appalling service delivery, which has just got worse and worse and worse. The implosion within the ANC, I mean, it clearly the ANC is in deep trouble. Everything it does is wrong. Everything it thinks it should achieve, it's not. It's basically by and large not achieving. And whatever the situation is, no one's benefiting from whatever happening in the ANC other than those who are benefiting from forms of corruption. So that's not unexpected. Unfortunately, it generally means, and probably will for a couple of years, that people don't switch to another party on the basis that, what the hell, you know, let's try somebody else. They tend just not to vote. And as I understand it, and you'd probably know better than I do, this does tend to favor the opposition parties, not the incumbent. But I can't, I mean, things should look really bad for the ANC because they are nowhere in a good place in any form whatsoever. And I think those the cherry on the top was probably the riots in July. It showed a government powerless, unable to make decisions, death, destruction. I think for the ordinary man in the street, it doesn't matter who it was. It was shocking. It was like the epitome of everything that the ANC has slid down towards. So it should be interesting for opposition parties, but I think the stay away vote will be large.
Gabriel, do you agree with all of that? Well, let's just see if your mic is working now. Let me make sure you're unmuted.
Yeah. There you are. Hopefully it's clearer. Perfect. Yeah, so I another way to look at this is just look at the past trends. So the ANC in the last national municipal election in 2016 got 52-53% of the vote. Before that, it got close on 60%. So if you just follow that same trajectory downwards, it's definitely dropping below a 50% majority. And that matters psychologically, I think, in the build up to the 2024 elections, because there's something very attractive about winning. I won't get into which politicians have made this point most uncouthly, but the ANC being the winner and will rule until Jesus comes, that kind of makes it difficult for people to imagine an alternative. The ANC drops below 50% in a national municipal election, and people start thinking, what's the alternative to those guys who've been winning all along while we've been losing? So I think that the ANC's got to be worried about that, because even on trend, it would be in that position. But it goes into that position facing much worse Auditor General reports on administration in municipalities, which is going to be an important issue in a lot of places, with unemployment much higher and with the party unable to pay its own staff and unable to campaign. I mean, I think we're back in the world, my final comment, of having to ask, what hat are you wearing now? Mr. Ramaphosa, because I think that the ANC will be doing a lot of door-to-door vaccine campaigning and a lot of TV time for the president with his presidential hat on for free advertising on the good ideas of the ANC's policy, because they can't afford proper radio ads, TV ads, or campaigning out in the wilderness. So it's difficult. And South Africans have registered. That's done now. It was relatively low, but it wasn't that different to what the IEC and the Concord expected. They expected about 600,000. They got maybe 350,000. So it'll be a legitimate election. And let's see how the cookie crumbles.
Indeed. So there's a number of big questions, I think, this election. So I just want to get to maybe your guys' early takes on these questions. The first is, will the DA be able to stabilize or grow? Because, of course, there's some question about whether that's going to happen. Will the EFF have a very good election? Will they ultimately fail before time? And will the IFP begin to claw back ground in KZN, of course, because that's another big battleground now with the ANC having a lot of decline in their vote share in KZN. And of course, all of this feeds into the central question of what exactly is going to happen in South Africa's big metros, which were very hotly contested in 2016. And Well, they're probably going to be very hotly contested again. And I wonder who the biggest party in all of those metros is going to be. And there's also parties like Action SA. We have no idea how well they're going to do. Not that many signs that they're going to do enormously well, but you never really know. So, Sara, let me get your take on any of those questions that you're interested in before we close.
To be unenlightening, I think to a large extent we actually don't know how well the opposition parties are going to do. I mean, I couldn't begin to guess. I mean, I don't have enough information to get a sense of what they should or what they would do. It should be, a party like the DA should improve their performance based on the fact that this is a bread and butter issue election. It's not about high ideals. It's not about policy. It's about who do you think can do a job for me? And it has a track record that nobody else has, but that doesn't necessarily swing it in South Africa, as we know. The IFP, I'm not sure about because, you know, since Buthelezi retired, I have had no sense of the IFP at all. But I say that from the basis of being, I'm here in Gauteng. I have no idea what's on the ground in KwaZulu-Natal, least of all rural KwaZulu-Natal.
The IFP are not historically a media-friendly party.
No, and clearly they haven't hit my media focus. But theoretically, if the ANC is in chaos everywhere, I mean, Natal was one of the two provinces where it had not registered the most candidates before this extended candidate application date. So, you know, if the IFP could get its act together, I think the ground is ripe for it. But as I say, I have no sense of the IFP at all. With regard to the EFF, again, also very difficult because although I think it will have some attraction, particularly to younger voters, because it's categorical about, well, I was going to say, not so much on where it stands as to what it's going to do. Well, I'm not sure it's categorical.
It's kind of a sex appeal.
Yeah, it's a kind of sex appeal. Red T-shirt, beret, aggressive talk, fists, very, very good look. But I'm not sure where, you know, they haven't won an award to date. That's quite something, given the fact that they've done
pretty well. I think they have won one in the Northwest. I think they won one near Marikana, I think. I may be wrong.
It's possible. But I mean, you know, as you say, what, the 300, over 300? I certainly don't think, you know, I think it's very much a feature of who are the youth going to vote. The youth are not known for being big voters. People tend to vote as they become more responsible as adults, so from 35 onwards. And I don't see the EFF's not going to largely appeal to that demographic. So the highly thought through answer is I really don't know.
And I think that's my view as well. Gabriel, in the next 2 minutes or so, your thoughts on all of those big questions?
Yeah, no, I mean, let's see. As I said, I think that the ANC is looking at dropping below 50%, and I think that's the headline finding. The rest of it is unclear. I do want to add, because we kind of glossed past this in mentioning the last story in the death of our mayor-elect, effectively, in the cavalcade, is that the reports seem to be contradictory. It is what does seem pretty clear is that he was a good guy. And so this is a loss for Johannesburg and not just for the ANC. And also that President Ramaphosa might have been in the same cavalcade. He was making the same journey. It's not clear if he was in the same
cavalcade. Yeah, they were definitely at the same event previously. So it's very possible they were traveling close to together.
And we've heard reports of Ramaphosa being booed over the weekend. Anyway, there is, when you look at how bad the accident must have been, it's not hard to imagine that it could have been slightly worse and knocked other cars out and that our president might have been killed. And I think that's a sobering reminder. Sometimes we say some pretty nasty stuff about the president, that no one wishes him personal harm, and that it's in a sense a good thing for the country, that it is clearly a good thing for the country that he's well protected by the security services. Although on the flip side of that, there's some question marks about whether the security services were doing their job properly. This accident's etiology or the causes of it are, as far as I can tell, very opaque. And whether there was human error involved in terms of speeding recklessly or something like that is really something that must be established, because it's the duty of the...
A really awful accident. Not only did the mayor die, but also the passenger of the car that crashed into his died, and I believe, according to Sora, a pedestrian as well was also killed. So it's a really awful accident.
So the job of the security services is to keep our politicians safe so that we can vote them out if we feel like it. And it's very important that they do that duty. So this is a worrying tale that I suppose will be covered in the future. I hope we'll get some clarity on that.
Indeed. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for watching. We hope you enjoyed. We hope you enjoyed listening and watching and all that good stuff. I'm going to leave a pinned comment at the bottom. Just ask you guys a question about the episode. Comment, let us know what you think. And of course, we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Cheers.